our series through the book of Genesis. And so this will be message number 26 in that series, entitled All's Fair in the End. We'll be looking at Genesis chapter 25, and so to get started, we'll look at verses 1 to 4. Then again, Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah, and she bare him Zimram and Yokshan, and Medan and Midian, and Ishbak and Shua. And Yokshan begat Sheba and Dedan, and the sons of Dedan were Ashurim and Latushim and Leumim. And the sons of Midian, Ephah, and Epher, and Hanok, and Abida, and Eldaah, and all these were the children of Keturah. So, for those of you that are parents here today, have you ever found yourself saying or doing something that your parents did or said, and you may have even at the time as you were growing up thought, I'm never going to say that or do that? And sometimes it happens in a moment of clarity, and I will repeat something that, you know, my mom or dad said, and suddenly realize, oh, that's why they said that. I get it now. Well, we're all born with an internal sense of fairness. So if an older brother or sister is given something or they're allowed some privilege that's denied to you, you complain that that's not fair. Now, the parents may explain that this is because this older brother or sister is older, or you're too young for whatever that it is, but that sort of reasoning never prevails with an offended sense of inner fairness. You know, we can't deal with that. Well, if other children are given something and you're given none of it or much less than everyone else, well, that's just a colossal injustice in your mind. Never mind that there may be good reasons sometimes that you didn't receive what others did. Well, our internal sense of fairness is something that is a part of our conscience makeup. It's evidence of our having been made in the image of God. The problem, of course, is that our consciences are also joined with a sinful nature and sin that dwells within each one of us. So our sense of fairness isn't perfectly fair, is it? In fact, it is decidedly slanted in our favor. We're not as concerned usually, especially when we're much younger, when the error is in our favor. Now, if I receive two pieces of candy and the other children get none, I'm not too bothered by that. I can live with it. I mean, that's the breaks after all, right? So we've all been told at some point by our parents or maybe some other figure of authority that the world's just not fair, or life is just not fair. When we've complained about these sort of things, parents, we've said this to our children, but life in the world isn't fair, at least not by our own internal sense of fairness. Now, in the atheistic worldview, that unfairness in the world and in life, that's all there is, without any purpose, without any hope. Of course, in the Christian worldview, and according to the Bible, there's both purpose and hope in seemingly random or unfair events. Why? Because the sovereign God of the universe is over all things, and he's working out his will for good to all those who believe in him. And Genesis 25 is full of these kinds of lessons that we have to learn. And we looked last time at Genesis chapter number 24, and it's a lengthy chapter. Abraham sends his servant to go get a wife for Isaac from his kindred. And this episode in chapter 24 is different than many of the others that we've looked at to this point in the book of Genesis, because we don't have any biblical indication of instructions to Abraham for this moment. And the account, in fact, seems to confirm that he had no such instructions. Abraham didn't have a dream. He didn't have a vision. He didn't have an appearance of the Lord. He didn't have any sort of word from the Lord what to do in this case with Isaac and his need for a wife. Well, what we see here then is just Abraham in the process of just normal life having to make decisions. And he's having to make decisions based on what had already been revealed to him, and to determine from that how that prior revelation informed his present choice. So God doesn't speak in that chapter. He doesn't in any way doesn't miraculously intervene in the things that take place in that chapter. What we see there is essentially what we would refer to the normal operation of providence. So that's what the chapter highlights, is living by faith and understanding that God is always at work to fulfill His Word. And that's whether we see some sort of extraordinary event or not. God is normally working in that way. Now, obviously, a wife for Isaac was crucial. He was the inheritor of the covenant and the promise of the descendants for Abraham. So he's obviously going to need a wife. And we see that that wife was provided. Now we come to chapter 25, and this chapter ends the account of Abraham with his death and his burial. Now this was obviously anticipated a couple chapters ago with the death of Sarah and her burial. And for both Abraham and Sarah, it highlights the important fact that God's covenant is not nullified by death. It will be kept. It will be fulfilled. His promises will be kept to whom they were made. In fact, the writer of Hebrews points out at the end of that great chapter, in chapter number 11, that Abraham and Sarah both died, along with many others, without receiving the promises, but that they will receive them, but they will receive them in the future, along with all of the others who die in faith when they receive their promises as well. So this chapter, chapter 25, brings Abraham's account to a close. And along with that, it brings the account of Ishmael to a close, and it transitions to Isaac along with Rebekah and their sons Jacob and Esau, which will take up the rest of the book of Genesis. So as we look at this chapter, and we're going to divide it into two parts, we'll have the first section, verses 1 to 18, we see the blessings of Abraham, and in verses 19 to 34, the covenant continuing with Isaac. So we're going to start here in the beginning with the blessings of Abraham, the first part of this chapter, verses 1 to 18. So let's look at verses 1 to 4 again. Then again, Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah. And she bare him Zimran, and Yokshan, and Medan, and Midian, and Ishbak, and Shua. And Yokshan begat Sheba, and Dedan. And the sons of Dedan were Ashuram, Letushim, and Leumim. And the sons of Midian, Ephah, and Epher, and Hanok, and Abida, and Eldaah, and all these were the children of Keturah. So the final account of Abraham, which is given to us in this first part of Genesis 25, is given along with Keturah and the sons that Abraham had with her. Now, we don't know anything else about Keturah. She's here called a wife. Later in verse number 6, she's referred to as a concubine, which would sort of count her along with Hagar in the family relations of Abraham. Now, it's not clear exactly when Abraham took her as a concubine or wife, or when these sons were born. But as we look at the genealogy that is given to us here, we might call it a minor genealogy, we have a record of 6 sons that Abraham and Keturah had, that the 7 grandsons that they had, and 3 great-grandsons that they had. And these children of Abraham, they are recognized, or they're recognizable, as the beginning of various different nations. Various nations they'd be referred to as some of the Arab nations. So we see names like Sheba and Dedan and Medan and Midianites and so on. And these can be later traced throughout Scripture and throughout the histories of Israel and the writings of the prophets. And these were nations that were neighboring nations to Israel. And Israel had, in many cases, longstanding conflicts with them and so on. Now, as we look at verses 5 and 6, and Abraham gave all that he had unto Isaac, but unto the sons of the concubines which Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac his son while he yet lived eastward unto the east country. So it's pointed out that, again, that Isaac was the sole heir of Abraham, and all the other sons were sent away, as it says, with gifts. Of course, this began with the sending away of Ishmael in chapter 21, verses 8 to 14. Now, we note that Moses references things like inheritance and sonship terms, like the use of birthright. These sort of terms is what are being alluded to or used here in this account. And he doesn't define or explain what those mean. And it's much like the way that he referred to clean and unclean animals in the account of Noah and the ark and the flood. In other words, these are things that are explained later. They're explained in the legal codes that are contained within the Pentateuch, this five-book collection that stands at the beginning of the Old Testament. And so as you look through there, then, and again, he's writing this to Israel in the plains of Moab, and so they would understand all of these concepts and all of these terms and what the expectation and the custom was. So what you learn from the law is that sons of legal wives, or sometimes referred to as full wives, were entitled to a share in the inheritance. In other words, so the law stipulated the right of inheritance that they had. Places like Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 15 to 17, the book of Numbers chapter 27, verses 1 to 11. Now, these were the sons of legal or full wives. But the sons of concubines, according to the law, did not have rights of inheritance. They didn't have any of those rights. And sons of concubines were basically dependent on, for whatever goodwill or grace or mercy that the father would wish, and just whatever that he chose to give them. He wasn't required by the law to give anything in particular to them, though probably in many cases, and like with the cases of Abraham, he did choose to do so. Now, Abraham and Sarah only had one son, and that son was Isaac. And he was the true and the sole heir of Abraham. And this would include the covenant that God made with him. And of course, God spelled that out very clearly in the previous chapters. And so, due to this fact, there are some that have come to this account and have concluded that, well, Keturah was never a full legal wife. I think they're assuming too much from that. But regardless, Isaac was clearly designated and remained the sole heir. And we see that again. Abraham gave all that he had unto Isaac. And he did this while he was still yet living. The sons of the concubines, which would include here at least Keturah and Hagar, it says that he merely gave them gifts and he sent them away from Isaac because they were not a part of the inheritance in any way. Then we come to verses 7 to 11. And these are the days of the years of Abraham's life which he lived, 115 years. Then Abraham gave up the ghost and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. And his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, which is before Mamre, the field which Abraham purchased of the sons of Heth. There was Abraham buried and Sarah his wife. And it came to pass after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac dwelt by the well of Lahai Roi. So Abraham's account here concludes now with his death and his burial announcement. We're told that he lived to a good old age, and even that phrase points back to the earlier promise in chapter 15 and verse number 15, when God promised Abraham that he would live to a good old age and prophesied that he would do so. So Abraham lived to be 175 years old, meaning that he lived for 100 years after God called him in the land of Canaan. Now, the language that's used here of Abraham living to a good old age and he's dying an old man and full of years and all these sort of things, the language that is used here is indicating that Abraham lived a long life and Abraham lived a full life. Abraham lived with great satisfaction in life. And of course, this is accounted for by the fact that from the very start, God promised to bless Abraham greatly. And to make him great, and to make his name great, and all of these various blessings. And when we track out the promises that God made in that covenant with Abraham, we realize that there's long lasting fulfillment of those promises that were made that went well beyond Abraham's lifetime, but still yet in Abraham's lifetime, he did receive some fulfillments of promises that were made, and him having a long and what you might call a good life. He had a prosperous life. He was blessed. He'd become a great man. He's a great patriarch. He'd become very powerful and influential in many ways in the land. All of these things, again, are accounted for by the promises that God made to Abraham. So when we get to the end of his life, we're given sort of this notice that God had kept his word to Abraham over all this long time. And this account ends noting that Isaac then was blessed just as God had promised. And of course, we're prepared for this account to transition to him. We're told that in verse 11, it came to pass after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac. And then again, we transition to the account of Isaac. So now we come to verses 12 to 18, which is the last part of this Abraham section, really. Now, these are the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's handmaid, bare unto Abraham. And these are the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names, according to their generations. The firstborn son of Ishmael, Nabaioth, of Kedar, and Kedar, and Abdiel, and Mibsam, and Mishma, and Duma, and Massa, and Hadar, and Tima, Yatur, Nafish, and Kedema. These are the sons of Ishmael. And these are their names by their towns and by their castles, 12 princes according to their nations. And these are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years. And he gave up the ghost and died and was gathered unto his people. And they dwelt from Havilah unto Shur, that is before Egypt, as thou goest toward Assyria. And he died in the presence of all his brethren. So before we fully transition to Isaac and to what's to follow, which really the transition to Isaac is a rather brief one because it's a transition to Isaac and quickly a transition to Jacob, which takes up the rest of the book of Genesis. But before we transition fully to Isaac, we are given this conclusion of Ishmael's account. Essentially, after this point, we will read of Ishmaelites from time to time, but Ishmael himself is over and done in this account. Now, this also contributes to the Abraham account and reminds us of God's promises, that there would be many nations that would come from Abraham. Now, obviously, the promised seed, Isaac, is going to lead to this seed nation, which becomes the nation of Israel. And that's obviously a major part of that covenant. But besides that, he had promised that there would be many nations that would come from Abraham, many kings and many princes. And so here, by the addition of this account of Ishmael, we see these promises as well coming true. This fulfillment of these promises concerning Ishmael, which he spoke specifically to Abraham and to Hagar. So we're told that there were 12 princes that came from Ishmael, 12 sons that are mentioned here in this account, fulfilling that promise that was made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 17 and verse number 20. And you notice at the end that it says that he died in the presence of all of his brethren. And the word for presence there essentially means in the face of. He died in the face of all of his brethren. And here what this indicates is that prophecy of conflict, that his hand would be against every man. Chapter 16 and verse number 12 that was given concerning Ishmael there to Hagar. And tracing the history of Israel throughout the rest of the Old Testament, we see that it is a history that is filled with conflict and filled with conflict with these brothers from Abraham, if you would. In fact, one of the things that we can observe in the book of Genesis is that how oftentimes that term brother is associated with just this sort of conflict, not just here, but throughout the book. So if you think about it, there were the various Arab nations that came from Keturah that we read about at the start of the chapter. And now we have a number of other nations as well that come from Ishmael, of these same Arab-type nations in that region. But we also have the Aramaeans and those that came through Nahor, Abraham's brother. And then we also have the nations that come from Haran and from Lot, the Ammonites and the Moabites and so on. So you have all of these nations that were in and around and bordering the land of Canaan and so on. And Israel has a history of conflict with these nations, even continuing to this day. And so even in the death of Ishmael, this conflict is pointed to. And then we come to the next part of this chapter where we see the covenant continuing with Isaac, but this conflict really begins to be seen. So we'll start here in verses 19 through 26. And these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begat Isaac. And Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister to Laban, the Syrian. And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord was entreated of him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. And the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it be so, why am I thus?" And she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said unto her, "Two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger and the other people than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger." And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red all over like a hairy garment, and he called his name Esau. And after that came his brother out, and his hand took hold on Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 80 years old when she bare them. So now we have another instance of prayer as Isaac prayed for Rebekah. We noticed how that the servant of Abraham prayed in the previous chapter as he was praying for guidance and God's blessing on his mission to go and to get a wife for Isaac. But here Isaac is praying, and he's praying because we're told Rebekah was barren. Now her barrenness obviously echoes that of Sarah's barrenness, and Isaac's prayer is a prayer of faith in the sense that God had promised Abraham descendants through Isaac. And so obviously Rebekah was going to have a child at least, but had not to this point, but had been barren. And so Isaac is praying about this. Now we also know of Isaac that he did not, in this instance, he did not take a concubine. He did not take a surrogate, as Abraham did. And especially given the testimony of chapter 24, we also know that Rebekah was the right woman in a manner of speaking. In other words, Abraham gives instructions to his servant to go and to get this wife, and the servant goes and all these things that happen, and you've got repeated witness in that chapter as to the fact that this is of God. This is God's doing. This is the right thing. And so you're left with no question by the time you come to the end of that chapter that Rebekah was the right woman, that her and Isaac were married, and obviously she enters into the covenant with him just as he inherited it from Abraham. And then as we come into this chapter now, we learn that they're married a long time and have not had any children because she is barren. Well, one of those sort of life applications and life lessons that we learn as we go along reading in the account of the patriarchs like this is that the right thing doesn't equal easy and painless. And oftentimes we think that way. Well, this has to be of the Lord because it all just worked out so perfectly. And it all went so well. And it was exactly what I wanted it to be. Well, that must be from the Lord. And then we look at another thing and say, well, this has been hard. This has been difficult. That can't be the Lord's will. That can't be the Lord's hand. This is painful. I'm not really enjoying this. But we have to understand that as we look at the lives of these patriarchs, their lives certainly were not perfect. Their actions themselves, their choices were not certainly not always perfect. But even the various difficulties and circumstances and trials and various things that they faced. So we shouldn't make the mistake of, again, thinking that the right thing is always going to be easy or painless. It may be sometimes. It seems to be that a lot of the times, though, that's not going to be the case. Now, then we get this prophecy concerning Jacob and Esau. So Rebecca is having, there's some sort of problems with her pregnancy, and it's not really clear what exactly was going on. It says the children were struggling in her womb, so I don't know if maybe she was having an unusual amount of pain, if what it was, but she knew that something's going on here. Something doesn't seem to be right. And we're told that she went and entreated the Lord. She went and prayed to the Lord. Where she went and how all of that happened, we don't know. But God actually answers her speaking to her. And we get this prophecy in verse 23. Two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. So Rebekah receives this prophecy concerning Jacob and Esau, and ultimately the prophecy is pertaining to the nations of Israel and the nation of Edom that would come from them. And the struggling in the womb was foreshadowing this ongoing struggle between the brothers themselves, but also between the nations that would come from them. And then we see when she finds out there are to be twins, and then they're born. And Esau comes out, and he gets a name, Esau, that's sort of a play on being hairy and red. He gets that name, and then Jacob gets a name as the baby is coming out, he takes hold of his brother's heel, and he gets a name Jacob that essentially means something like taking the heel or something like that. And what that name indicates, it means a cheater. It's one who trips up someone. So you grab the heel. So imagine if you're running in a race, you know, and you trip your competitor so that you get the advantage and get to go on and win. That's the sort of the idea. That's the grabbing of the heel that is mentioned. So even his name reflects that fact about Jacob. And as you go on, you know that his character reflects that as well. And especially here, right from the start at the end of this account. So verses 27 to 34. And the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And Jacob sawed pottage, and Esau came from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint." Therefore was his name called Edom. And Jacob said, "Sell me this day thy birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, I'm at the point to die, and what profit shall this birthright do to me?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me this day," and he sware unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. So we're told that the twin boys, that as they grow up together, it became evident that obviously they looked different, but they were also different, it seems, in their temperaments and in their makeup. Esau was a hunter, a man of the field, an outdoorsman. Jacob, a plain man dwelling in tents, more of a farmer, more of a shepherd type. So they had different interests and perhaps different skills that they developed and affinities. And not only that, but we also find that there was a difference made in them by their parents. So they had differing preferences. Isaac preferred Esau, the firstborn, and Rebekah preferred Jacob, the secondborn. Now, the birth order, nor the preference of the parents, nor their particular skills or abilities as sons or what have you, none of those things determined God's plan to be fulfilled for them. In other words, Paul refers to this part of Genesis in Romans chapter number 9, verses 10 to 12, writing, "And not only this, but when Rebekah also had conceived by one, even by our father Isaac, for the children being not yet born, neither having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God according to election might stand, not of works, but of him that calleth, it was said unto her, the elder shall serve the younger." Of course, Paul is referring to the fact that God's election, God's choice, is not based on any attributes that they may have had. They were both physically and genetically, biologically, they're the children of Isaac and Rebekah. They are the very same. And yet even though you had one that was older in Esau and one that's younger in Jacob, God said that he had chosen Jacob. And so Jacob, just like Isaac was chosen over Ishmael, Jacob then is the one to whom is going to inherit the covenant and is going to continue. So that was the prophecy that was made concerning them. And again, it wasn't a difference that was made because preferences of their parents or any of those things, but that this is God's will being worked out. And so we want to have that in mind as we read this account. And Jacob, we might say, was rather deceitful or unethical in his practices and ways. But again, we want to keep in mind that this is the working out of God's will. Now, so the chapter ends then with Jacob essentially buying or taking or cheating Esau out of his birthright. But what is the birthright? Well, the birthright refers to the right of the firstborn. And the right of the firstborn was a right to the double portion of inheritance and the position as the head of the family. So you can read this in places like Exodus chapter 22 and verse 29, Numbers chapter 8 verses 14 to 17, Deuteronomy chapter 21 and verse number 17. So in the case of Isaac and his two sons, there were two sons, and so the inheritance that would be left for them would be divided into three portions. And then the eldest, then, that would be his birthright, he would receive the double portion. So he would receive two portions of that inheritance, or two-thirds of that inheritance, and then the younger, Jacob in this case, would receive one-third of that inheritance. That's the birthright that is referred to. So this case, of course, in this case, we know that there's also the inclusion of the heir of the covenant, as it was with Isaac and Ishmael. And this could have been part of the reason, of course, that Jacob valued it so highly, but we're not really told as much about his motives and thoughts. And then Moses concludes this account at the end of verse 34 with Esau despised his birthright. He esteemed it of very little value. And of course, he had just sold it to Jacob for a bowl of soup, a bowl of vegetable soup and some bread. He had just sold his birthright for that. And so Moses, again, gives us this editorial type comment, theological type comment, that Esau despised his birthright. So this chapter, chapter 25, contributes in a number of ways to the book of Genesis in particular as a whole. We have a theme that develops in the book of Genesis, and that is of the younger being blessed over the older. So you can see that with Abel and Cain. You can see that with Isaac and Ishmael. You can see that with Rachel and Leah. You can see it with Joseph and the 10 older brothers that he had. You can see it with Judah and his older brothers, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, that were older than him as well, and the blessing that he received. So this is a theme that goes along. And we might conclude that, oh, well, then that just means that God always does the unexpected thing. So if we think God's going to do something, he's going to do the opposite. And you know, that we always had that trick that we could use they call it the reverse psychology. You know, you want somebody to do something, so you tell them to do the opposite. They're so contrary by nature that they're going to do the opposite, and so you get them to do what you want to do. And so, you know, we do that in school and all kinds of things like that. But that is not the way that God works. God is not preferring the younger in these cases simply because he wants to surprise us, or he wants to do things differently than what we think he should do them. That's not the point. What is being highlighted, and this obviously comes out from Paul's reference to this chapter in Romans chapter number 9, what is being highlighted here is that God's purpose and God's election of whom he will is independent of natural positions, it's independent of customary rights, and it shows God's grace in blessing the younger over the older, because they're what? Well, by nature and custom and everything, they're undeserving, is what they are. They don't have that right to that blessing, but yet they get it. Why? Because of God's grace. And the point that Paul's making is that because God chose to show them that grace. They didn't earn it. They didn't deserve it. They didn't merit it in any way. Now that's Paul's point in Romans chapter number 9. So again, as we read these accounts and we see these sort of things, we want to come to the right conclusion about them. Well, this chapter also contributes to this theme of conflict that is so prevalent in the book of Genesis. When you think about it, conflict starts early. By Genesis chapter 4, we have conflict with Cain and Abel. And conflict just continues throughout the book of Genesis. By the end of the book, though, God's purpose is explicitly stated as being fulfilled through these conflicts, or we might say in spite of them. That's in Genesis chapter 50 and verse number 20. We'll get there eventually. Now, the point is that these conflicts are the result of the cross purposes of men, but they do not prevent God's will from being accomplished. And ultimately, these conflicts will be resolved, and they will be resolved by the coming Prince of Peace and His Kingdom of Peace. So we have these, you have this prophecy of Ishmael, of how there would be all this conflict, and his hand was going to be against every man. Now you've got this prophecy of Jacob and Esau, and how that there's going to be conflict and struggling between them and between the nations that descend from them. But then we can also turn over to the prophecies of that future time when Christ returns, when Israel is gathered and restored. And we read things like in Isaiah chapter 60, verses 1 to 15. Arise, shine, for thy light is come, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon thee. For behold, the darkness shall cover the earth, and gross darkness the people. But the Lord shall arise upon thee, and this is speaking to Israel, and his glory shall be seen upon thee. And the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising. Lift up thine eyes round about and see. All they gather themselves together, they come to thee. Thy sons shall come from far, and thy daughters shall be nursed at thy side. Then thou shalt see and flow together, and thine heart shall fear and be enlarged, because of the abundance of the sea shall be converted unto thee. The forces of the Gentiles shall come unto thee. The multitude of camels shall cover thee. The dromedaries of Midian and Ephah and all they from Sheba shall come. They shall bring gold and incense, and they shall show forth the praises of the Lord. All the flocks of Kedar shall be gathered together unto thee. The rams of Nabaoth shall minister unto thee. They shall come up with acceptance on mine altar, and I will glorify the house of my glory. Who are these that fly as a cloud and as the doves to their windows? Surely the isles shall wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish first to bring thy sons from far, their silver and their gold with them, unto the name of the Lord thy God, and to the Holy One of Israel, because he hath glorified thee. And the sons of strangers shall build up thy walls, and their kings shall minister unto thee. For in my wrath I smote thee, but in my favor have I had mercy on thee. Therefore thy gates shall be open continually. They shall not be shut day nor night, that men may bring unto thee the forces of the Gentiles, and that their kings may be brought. For the nation and kingdom that will not serve thee shall perish. Yea, those nations shall be utterly wasted. The glory of Lebanon shall come unto thee, the fir tree, the pine tree, the box together, to beautify the place of my sanctuary, and I will make the place of my feet glorious. The sons also of them that afflicted thee shall come bending unto thee, and all they that despise thee shall bow themselves down at the soles of thy feet. And they shall call thee the city of the Lord, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel, whereas thou hast been forsaken and hated, so that no man went through thee, I will make thee an eternal excellency, a joy of many nations. So in that prophecy of that millennial kingdom time when Israel turns and receives her Messiah and is restored to that land, and Jesus Christ sits enthroned on Mount Zion, on David's throne, you see even many of these nations that we read about here in Genesis chapter 25 being named. They that afflicted you shall come and bend. They shall come and bow. And all of these various Gentile nations, says, they will flow into Zion, into Jerusalem, and bring their rich gifts and all of these things to honor the king and to honor that nation when this is when God restores them. So here we see these prophecies of these beginnings of these conflicts. These conflicts are not resolved. They're not resolved today. They're not resolved right now. And they will not be resolved until Jesus Christ comes again to stand upon this earth and Israel is gathered and restored, just like we read there in Isaiah chapter number 60. Well, finally, in all of this, we see God's sovereignty and we see it over against human responsibility, that old difficulty that we always struggle with. Well, here we have Isaac and Rebekah and Jacob that are all acting out of their own interests and designs. They're all doing things for their own reasons and own purposes, but none of that prevents God from accomplishing his purpose. We might think, oh, well, this person is gone off doing things that's going to most benefit them. Isn't that just going to mess up everything for everybody else? No, God rules over all. And God works even through these. And we see that they are accountable. Why? Because they suffer consequences for the actions that they take and the choices that they make. So God is not prevented from accomplishing his purpose because people are doing what they want to do. No, he works through it and he brings his purposes to be. Now, to take a lesson from that, God's sovereignty should never make us careless. It should never make us think, oh, well, you know, I can just live life to just pursue what I want. That's what I can do. No, but it should lead us to repentance, rather. God is completely just. God is completely righteous. And God is completely fair. And he will judge the whole world according to his righteousness. Not according to my righteousness, not according to your righteousness, not according to the righteousness of Jacob or Israel, but according to his perfect righteousness. And that means that every one of us will receive a fair judgment from God. And that only means condemnation unless we repent of our sins and believe in God's Son, the Messiah, the Holy One of Israel, for the forgiveness of sins and the blessings of eternal reward.